Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Lacey Jane Wolfe, and we are going to be talking about The Obelisk Gate by N.K. Jemisin, which won the 27 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So hi there, Lacey Jane. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Seth. I'm really excited to talk about this book with you.
Yeah, I'm excited too. So why don't you talk a little about yourself? What's your history as a science fiction fan?
I'd love to. I'm a city planner in the Seattle area, okay. And I work in local government. I'm not a podcaster, but I love to read, and I've loved listening to your podcast. I've listened to a lot of the episodes as I read through the Hugos. Growing up, my parents were big readers, and my mama always made sure we had plenty of books around for us kids to, you know, tear into and read. We also didn't have television in the house until I was in middle school. Mm. So that left a lot of time open for reading. Yeah. She and my dad introduced me to science fiction, though, largely through movies, which some of which, you know, I now understand looking back, like Total Recall, were based on science fiction classics.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun. Those really captured my imagination. And I think also helping me on my path to being a big reader were my elementary school teachers. Giving a shout out to Mrs. Varner and Mrs. Roverson of Emerson Elementary. They had this lending library in their 4, 5, 6 classroom, and kids could take out a book or two, and they kindly looked the other way when I took out many more. And they set up lots of time and really fostered that love of reading.
Nice.
I think The Giver was one of my earliest sci-fi books I read, and that they had made that available to me. So really appreciating those elementary school teachers for their help with that.
Nice. That's cool. It's always interesting to hear the difference between, like, there's people who engage science fiction with books or with movies, and it seems like either way you get introduced to it, you find your way to all of it.
Yes, I agree. And how fun it is. I know you're a big fan of comparing and contrasting movie versions or TV versions with the books. And I always think that's a fun conversation. Although I am insistent upon always, always reading the book first. Okay. I have a bias in that way.
And that may harm your experience of some of the movies, I'm sure.
Yep. I think that's true. It's just, it's hard to do it as well as the books do it.
Yep. Yep. Well, cool. You mentioned that you had tracked how many of the Hugo winners you've read.
Yes, I think you and I are neck and neck. Okay. I have read 67. I've got 3 to go.
Okay.
And I know you're up in the 60s too. Is that right, Seth?
Yeah, I'm at 63, so you've got a little lead on me.
Yes. I was hoping I could be in the lead for this. I've got 2 Zelaznys and a Heinlein to go.
So how was it that you came to the project of trying to read them all?
Yes. Well, actually, this Broken Earth trilogy really set me down that path.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, I really agree with, you know, what Ursula K. Le Guin wrote, that, you know, science fiction isn't about predicting the future. It's about talking about and commenting on our present reality and issues. Mm. And I loved that about these books. I hope we'll get a chance to talk about that later. But I think, like many of your other guests, you know, I was really interested to know how were other authors doing this throughout time? The Vietnam War, you know, so many different, you know, coming to understand the internet and its risks and its benefits. You know, how were other authors through time sort of exploring these ideas? I've really loved that.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, that kind of segues nicely into why this book. It sounds like this book set you on the project. Or not this book, but the series. Yeah.
Yes, it absolutely did. This series really helped me to think about and stirred me to think about several things. I think one of them really being institutional racism. Mm. Even though I took classes on racism in criminal justice system and in the education system in college, there's something about fiction, this book and others, that really engages me to think about it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, she's doing that by showing us a totally alien world, but that has this power and class system set up and is done so deliberately by the people in power. And that really helped me think about and approach those issues in a different way. And then sort of more on the personal side to me, this book in particular was so powerful to me because of because of Nassen's voice, okay. Essen's daughter, and dealing with that, I think, intergenerational trauma. And I think, you know, as a member of the LGBTQ community, I really empathized with her journey and her relationship with her father, who wants to cure her of her orogeny. And and I think they say, you know, his love comes wrapped in pain. You know, I think that's just such a compelling and difficult thing to think about that I found a lot of connection to. So I'm really happy to be talking about this book with you.
Yeah, because, you know, part of it was, part of my question there is, why do you choose the middle book in a trilogy, right?
Yeah, I think it's Nassen's voice really that that made this one so compelling to me. But the whole series is I think very powerful, and so enjoying all of it. But this one in particular, I think, spoke to me.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were just trying to be nice to me and not make me do the first book and the third book, and then sometime fill in the middle one.
I think I was also, I knew you had a long list, and I was so excited to get going. I thought, I'll take the second book because I can go earlier. And those trilogies, you know, they're hard to get into, or the ones where the Hugo, you know, is award winner is the third book. Mm-hmm. And I always feel compelled to read through the earlier books before I read that one. And those have a very delayed payoff.
Yeah, yeah. And there's definitely been times where I've been working on doing one of the books that is in a series, and I've talked to people who've read it and like, should I read the first one? They're like, no, you know, like with, I did A Deepness in the Sky before I did Fire on the Deep, and that worked fine because they're 100,000 years apart or something like that in the same timeline. But here it would have been strange to go to The Stone Sky first. I feel like I absolutely would have had to read. I would have had to do some homework. It was kind of the same with when I did the Vor game. I had never read any of the Vor Kosigan novels. And so I asked Dan, and he's like, yeah, you should probably read the first couple of books before you get to that one. And so
I agree with that, even though I think I'm more of a Vor Kosigan saga fan than you are.
Oh, no,
I didn't mind it so much. Oh, good. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. My library system has all the audiobooks, and so I've listened to all of them at this point. And so I'll eventually get back to Mirror Dance, and Beriar is my next one up, actually. So,
oh, those are two good ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So why don't we go ahead and dive into the non-spoiler discussion of this book? And we usually do a little elevator pitch or non-spoiler synopsis. With a second book in a series, I assume that if people are listening to this, they've probably read the first book. But if you want to set this one up for us.
Absolutely. Yes. Again, emphasizing the warning, if you haven't read the first book, stop listening. I encourage you and go back and read it, because this is not one to read out of series. Here's my spoiler-free synopsis of the book. So the Obelisk Gate picks up where the fifth season left off, practically mid-sentence. Right. They leave you on a cliffhanger. And so, as you know, in the stillness, a seismic event has just taken place that will cloud the sky with ash for 10,000 years and create an age of winter that will last millions of years. And this is going to end humanity. So very dire straits to start out with. But this seismic event, this rift, wasn't just a natural disaster. It was intentionally caused by an origin, one of the people who can use their bodies and minds to redistribute energy. So Essen, our main character, is an origin, and she's in this book struggling to understand why her friend caused this rifting. What did he hope to accomplish, and what is she going to do about it? And as we talked about before, unlike the first book, this book introduces two new voices, Nassen and Shafa. And they're very important central characters in this book as well. So Essen's daughter, Nassen, is an origin. I think she's about 8 years old. And her father, Jija, as we talked about, is on this journey to cure her of her orogeny. Mm-hmm. And so she's really struggling to not only survive his beatings and his hatred, but also to come to terms with something in her mind that was even worse, which was the lessons from her mother in how to survive in this world. Mm-hmm. And then another really interesting character I'm looking forward to speaking with you about is Shafa. And he's a guardian who controlled and terrorized even while he protected Essen when she was a little girl. And very happy that in this book, at least, that Shaffa is questioning his role in controlling her and what he did to her. And he's really trying to make things right. But that's a journey and a difficulty. Yeah. So that's, Seth, that's my elevator pitch for the many things that happen in this book without spoilers.
Yeah, yeah. This one does not have the same structure as the first book. The first book is told in several different time periods, and you don't find that out until the end, where this one is much more straightforward, A plot and B plot, right? Where we have the A plot following Essen and the B plot following Nassen, which those names are similar enough that it's pretty easy to confuse them. But they're still told, the Essen chapters are still told in second person. And so it's easy to tell which plot you're in, right? Based on that.
Yes, that's so true. And I think, you know, coming from the first book and then continuing in this one in the second person with her voice, she's definitely the character that I, you know, feel most connected to. And, you know, I'm, to my mind, I'm really sort of going through this in her perspective. But Nassen's telling of what's been happening to her during the first book, boy, does that change some of my feelings and ideas about Essen in very complicated ways.
Yes, definitely. Because you have that, well, Shaffa, you know, when you, and this isn't real spoilers unless you haven't read the first book, you know, is kind of an antagonist, right? Because the Guardians, in controlling Origines, if the Origines go astray, then they're tasked with essentially turning them into piles of goo, right? and there's something about them that, there's something in their brains that we learn more about in this book that gives them some kind of pleasure from causing, from taking Orogeny from the Origines. And that's interesting. And Shaffa was doing bad things at the end of the previous book and was apparently dead. We thought he was dead. And we find out in this book.
We hope.
Not so much. Yeah. Yeah.
But
he's
so
also
much.
Different, right? And, It's interesting, and I want to talk more about it in spoilers, about the differences in Shaffa and how kind of he's come to understand the Guardians, and is there a free will element there, or is there a control element?
Absolutely. And I think you hit on something really important there too, Seth, to me, which is that coming to know and coming to understand what happened to Shaffa and what motivates him.
Yeah.
Because the last book was a, you know, a book about journeys. And this book, I think, is more about getting to know these characters and delving deeper into who they are and their motivations. And then understanding this terrible world. What happened? Why? What are the factions? What's going on? How did they come to think that this was the way things have always been?
Right.
And I think like getting at that nut and the heart of it, you know, that mystery part of it really kept me turning the pages and wanting to know more and more. With every question I got answered, I had 10 more questions.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I haven't given sort of overall thoughts about this one. Sounds like you enjoyed it.
Definitely. This one's a big recommend to me.
Okay. I really enjoyed this one as well. The funny thing is, after I finished the first book in this series, I listened to the audiobook. I track all my reading, and I listened to the audiobook, and I gave it like an 8 out of 10. I remembered absolutely nothing. I mean, nothing. It was shocking to me how little of the book I remembered.
Goodness.
I couldn't have told you any of the major plot points, and it's really strange to have a book that I obviously enjoyed. And then I read this time and I'd been a little apprehensive. I thought, oh, I'm not sure that I liked that because I couldn't remember it. And so then I started reading. I'm like, wow, I'm really enjoying this. So I think it was just a book that I'm not reading for the podcast. I pay a different level of attention to, and I knew that I was going to come back and read it in print later. And so I think it was just one of those audiobooks that if my mind wandered, I was like, don't stress. It's fine. I'll get back to it later. So now I'm listening to, The Stone Sky, and I'll probably forget it as well before I move on to the other one. Although there's some plot points in the Stone Sky that are major questions that I had in the second book, and so I feel like I'll remember some of that better.
Well, I'm going to be so curious. I'm looking forward to chatting with you today, but I'm going to be so curious to hear also your discussion of the third book, because, you know, sometimes I can read through a whole book not really loving it, and then, you know, the end, the way things are framed and wrapped up, you know, makes me like it so much better, or the reverse.
Yes.
So I'll be curious to hear when you finish the trilogy, you know, how you feel and if you feel the same way about it as you did in the middle.
Yeah, there's definitely been books that have been, you know, the third book in a trilogy that I've been kind of like, but I bump it up a whole letter grade if it parks it well. So
I totally get that.
So usually we do the sort of comps to the book and who might like this novel. We did it with The Fifth Season. And so I don't know if you have specific titles that you want to talk about for comps for The Obelisk Gate.
I'd love to share a couple.
Okay.
I think, you know, comparable to other books that show you an alien world that prompt you to think about your own world. Mm. To me, those classics are Ursula K. Le Guin's, you know, Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed, also Hugo winners.
Yeah.
And I think that people would like this series of books that also explore sort of intergenerational trauma, intergenerational drama. So books like The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett or Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. I reached for some non-sci-fi ones because I don't think that too many sci-fi books do deal with those family traumas. So a little bit different. And then you know, don't have any particular things, but I really do think that this book is at least part mystery in that you're trying to really figure out what is going on in so many ways about this book. And so I think people who love a good mystery and love to think, you know, figure things out are going to find this rewarding because you don't get, you know, two or three chapters at the beginning telling you the chronological history of what's happening. You're thrust in the middle and you have to figure it out as you go. And there's a lot of wondering. And I think sometimes in the information age where we can find everything on Wikipedia, there's not many times when we get to experience that mystery and that unknowing. And I think that's a big part of why I like these books.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree that the world building here is really skillful because it's not, you don't just get chapters and chapters of exposition dump. You're in the character viewpoint and they don't know that much about the history. And there's a little nuggets of the excerpts from the writings and that kind of stuff that put a little color in there. And at the end of, in the appendix of the book, there's like the history of all the different seasons and that kind of stuff. So you can dive into that if you want to, but does it matter, you know, how the earth came to be this way? Now, in this book, it does, of course, matter because it definitely is the middle book. It's setting up what is going to be the conflict or the accomplishment that needs to happen in the third book. And it's teased by Alabaster at the end of the first one. Have you ever heard of the moon? And it's amazing to me, like the idea that someone would have that question.
Yes!
And that's really interesting. And it's, of course, talked about in this one.
Absolutely. And I really loved those pieces of stone lore that were being shared and a bit showed some of the thought processes behind the people who were controlling information. And I really loved that part. And yes, to be so surprised at the end of the first book, I remember, you know, I didn't even notice that throughout the whole first book, the moon, no one ever talks about the moon or sees the moon. And so what a shocker and what a twist. Mm-hmm. And I loved that was how we finished off the first book and we started the second book. And I have a non-spoiler question for you. I was thinking of the first book, The Fifth Season, as sort of fantasy first, sci-fi second. Mm. And this book has a lot more science fiction elements and a lot of science about rocks, satellites, energy. You know, for you, do you think this book tips over into more sci-fi than fantasy, or do you think it's still more fantasy than sci-fi?
Oh, it's interesting because I think I would have said the opposite. I would have said that this book brings in more of the fantasy element because you have the element of what Nassun calls the silver, and Alabaster calls magic. And for me, that completely reframed everything. I'm like, okay, so we're talking about magic here. So this is definitely fantasy.
So interesting.
But there's a technological fantasy to it too, with the satellites and the obelisks and all that kind of stuff. But if you can have a big crystal in the sky, a giant crystal in the sky that can follow somebody around in a smaller form, That sounds like fantasy to me.
But if it were a spaceship, it would be sci-fi.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I guess some kind of nanotechnology where it can make itself smaller, like the in the Transformers movie, the AllSpark.
Right. To me, the fantasy part is just that they don't know how it works,
right,
and they call it magic.
Yes.
And I had a lot of fun thinking about that. And boy, did I learn a lot about rocks from these books.
Yeah. And you know, Clark's law, right? Is it magic or is it some right? sufficiently advanced technology? Because, you know, you could look at it and go, okay, is the silver just some kind of biomachines? You know, it could be. I don't know. I haven't read the third book, so I don't know. everything that I've read in it so far makes it seem more fantasy-ish.
Well, I like that we can have opposite views about it because I think that makes talking about it more fun.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should probably just go into spoilers and that way if people want to jump off now, they can.
Yes, jump off. Don't spoil it for yourself. But getting past the spoilers, that's my favorite part of your podcast.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's a lot of YouTube videos out there and other things that, you know, will recap a book, but very few where folks talk about, you know, what did they think? What did it mean to them?
Right.
And I really love that about your podcast because that's exactly what I would want to do with a friend.
Yeah.
If I could convince any of my friends to read 70 sci-fi books with me, but instead of that, I have you, Seth.
Right. Yep. That's why I'm here. So, and of course the rest of the Hugo collective, Hugo Girl
that's
and
right.
Hugo Nebula readership. Yeah. I did say that I really enjoyed this one, on the reread, which was, felt like a first time read for me. Let's, you know, whatever topics you want to talk about. The one thing that I wanted to mention was in the first book, you have, you know, you find out late in the book that Alabaster is the one who cracked the continent. Right.
Right.
And the question is, well, why would you do that? And I think it's this book where you kind of find out he's trying to free up enough kind of ambient energy that a powerful origin could use the obelisk gate to try and catch the moon. Is that your understanding as well?
It is. And I think the books keep us in attention for a while about whether he's trying to save the world or destroy the world.
Right.
And, you know, that's continued later. And I love that because I think, you know, clearly Alabaster has enough rage and anger that he could just want to say, we're just going to burn this down and that's the end. And, you know, those are the questions too that Essen and Nassen are so dealing with. And I thought that was really compelling. I almost, in our non-spoilers, wanted to compare this book or give a shout out to anybody who, you know, roots for the bad guy in books, or movies, because, you know, a little bit of me, you know, in that idea of like revolution versus reformation, you know, pulls for the revolution, pulls for a complete dismantling of a system that's hurting so many people. And I thought that was really powerful. So I felt like Alabaster kind of teetered on the edge, but, were you surprised that Alabaster and Essen were kind of pulling more toward that, fixing things and trying to make things right? Did you never consider that either of them might want to just totally destroy the world?
I was kind of on the side of, given what we knew about Alabaster's, you know, children being turned into node maintainers, you know, which is horrifying. Yeah, I thought he might be on the side of let's just bring it all down, leave it to the Stone Eaters. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think, you know, that to have a contrast in the book, you have Essen trying to figure out how to use the obelisks to catch the moon to potentially end the seasons forever. And then Nassen tending more towards and she's being talked to by another Stone Eater, right? Mm-hmm. No, let's bring this all down. Let's do something bad. So, and that's a fun kind of, it sets up the confrontation for the next book.
Yes, I agree. And I think that also so interesting how if there was any doubt from the last book that there are no pure heroes or pure villains, that is, you know, if there's any doubt lingering around, that's completely destroyed in this book. It's made clear that everybody, even the heroes in this book, you know, are mass murderers and have these deep flaws, and So I think that that part is really interesting, especially where they're many of them are sort of questioning their humanity. I took a look in and found that Essen, Nossen, Alabaster, Hoa, and Shafa all call themselves monsters at some point in the book. You know who doesn't? Jija. Jija is not concerned that he has lost his humanity. And it made me think, like, I think this is to say something about humanity. What did you think of that part in Jija?
Yeah, that's a good point about that, because he is sort of the face of garden variety human evil, right? Where somebody who is so prejudiced against a particular type of human that he would beat his child to death because he showed signs of it, which is just shocking. And that shock remains in this book because, of course, Nossen discovers that and yet is still like driven by her affection for her father to sort of almost forgive him for it and understand it, which is strange.
Yes. So strange. Such an interesting commentary on human nature where we, can forgive those things, can forgive people who hurt us. You know, she saves his life multiple times and he looks at her with hatred and calls her an animal. And I think that is so painful to think about, but very powerful at the same time. And I also got the feeling that if we had at some point been seeing things from Jija's perspective, we might even come to find sympathy for him too, because Shafa, he tries to get Nossen to dig in a bit, and she does, about why he hates Origene so much. Yeah. And it comes, in part from something that traumatized him when he was young, but also from deliberate, I think, efforts by the Fulcrum and others to, force everyone to see Origins as inhuman.
Right. Yeah. And Jemison does such a good job of sort of humanizing and showing understanding motivations, because if you have somebody like Jija or really any other person who's suspicious of Origins because they've seen an untrained Origene do something horrifying, ice an entire village or accidentally kill a child, or one of their playmates or something. And I think we do see something like that had happened with, I can't remember if it was one of the characters in the book or if it was Jija, but you can understand why there would arise this system that said, well, hey, let's give some training. Let's spot these kids, who have the high midichlorian counts. because I feel like with the silver here, that's N.K. Jemison going, hey, I can do midichlorians and make it work. But, kind of making it understandable why a place like the Fulcrum would come to exist, and that it would be wrapped in the idea of, well, we're protecting humanity by traumatizing this group of people in order to train them. But then some of the uses they put them to, including like the node maintainer stuff, you're like, no, okay, I was sort of understanding, and now that's gross. That's really horrifying.
It really is. And I found, some connections. I was recently listening to your podcast about the city and the city and a discussion of, what we choose to see and what we choose not to see.
Yeah.
And I think you're talking about people experiencing homelessness as one of those examples that I think was given by the author. To me, this book helped me think about something that I don't see and I don't think about, as much as I should. Which is institutional racism.
Yeah.
And in particular, this had me thinking a lot about mass incarceration and how, out of sight, out of mind, how I can just ignore, the way that our system is set up and, what Michelle Alexander and others, call the new caste system.
Right.
And I think, looking at the way the stone lore and the motivations of the people in power before the rifting was discussed, really made me think about how deliberately its message to us, to blame the victim or to make this seem normal, where, when we think about it, we have a higher percentage of Black people in the United States living in U.S. prisons than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. Oof. You know, that is unthinkable. And how could that seem natural or something that was not done, you know, very intentionally to set up to protect people's power? And right. and so I loved that about this book, that it really pushed me to be thinking about that.
Yeah. That reminds me of, I did an interview with Nicholas Bukola, who wrote the book, The Fire is Upon Us, about the Baldwin-Buckley debates. He's a local author here. And thinking back to the Baldwin-Buckley debates where William F. Buckley wants to say, look, yes, there's some bad things happening with the sheriffs using cattle prods on black children and women and protesters, you know, but that's just a few bad apples. But what's happening in the black community, that's a systemic thing. That is something that is, you know, there's a personal responsibility angle there, but the bad cops, that's just, you know, those are rare cases. And that's how systemic racism works.
Right. And such dangerous messaging.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it excuses things and, you know, tries to justify. I think, you know, anybody who's interested in the this topic, I really would encourage you to read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, because she walks through and gives evidence about the deliberate replacement and messaging shifting from Jim Crow to this law and order, war on drugs, way right. to control black people and lock them out of opportunity. You know, not just people who are incarcerated, but people who have experienced, you know, incarceration. They're locked out of jobs. They're locked out of housing,
right.
You know, federal benefits, you know, just the, a number of things, you know, the ability to vote in some cases. And I think that that this book, you know, really prompted me to the Broken Earth trilogy really prompted me to think about these things and to pursue more information. So I encourage anybody who read this book and was thinking, this sounds very familiar. What is this making me think of? Yeah. I encourage you to go check out The New Jim Crow.
Yeah. And 13th, the movie about the 13th Amendment.
Oh, great point. Yeah.
There's another think great of that. One.
You know, it would be a nice fiction to think that, you know, my accomplishments, my income, you know, my personal wealth is a result purely of my hard work,
right.
and that I had the same chance as everybody else. But as a white person, you know, I'm rarely confronted with the idea that the privileges that I had, the head start that I got, came at the cost of other people.
Right.
And is that, you know, in what way is that okay? And, mm-hmm. You know, what am I going to do about it? You know, the same question that Essen's struggling with, right? Mm-hmm. How do we break it down and build back better? You know, what is my personal responsibility? So those are painful things to think about. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes science fiction, you know, gives us a little bit of escapism and a little bit of a buffer to confront things that are really hard and, you know, brings them in a way that we can really engage with them.
Yeah. The thing with Nasun and Jija, it's so interesting because you have the history of trauma with the way that Essun was, in her mind, helping Nasun to control her orogeny, right? The same way that she was taught to do it. And that's another one of those things where kind of institutional racism, you have people who will pass on the bad stuff that happened to them because it helped them to get to the place where now I'm safe. And you know, that stuff happened to me and it turned me into who I am and I'm safe in this way. So I'm going to do that to the next generation instead of trying to find a better way. And that kind of drives Nasun to have more affection for Jija than for Essun.
It does. She seeks shelter in him, and his outright violence and hatred is preferable to her
yeah.
to what she gets from her mother. And I don't know about you, but you know, in the first book, you know, I had a picture in my mind, you know, Essun is off to rescue Nasun from right. Jija, who kidnapped her after murdering Uche. Well, we quickly realize that even as Jija is standing over Uche's body and trembling with rage still, Nasun prefers him and is only really interested in escaping her mother. So yeah. for Nasun, it's an escape, not a kidnapping. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild.
It is wild. And I think, you know, we have, it's interesting, I think, in that a number of characters are seen both as the oppressor or the antagonist to one person, but then the rescuer to someone else,
right.
like Shafa,
yeah.
You know, who so abused Essen and traumatized her so that she can't even look at a glass of red wine without having a panic attack because of the burgundy color in his clothes, you know. But then to Nassen, you know, he's her safe place, her protector, who saves her from both of her parents and whom she loves so much. And I thought that was really interesting that he could be Essen's monster, and he could still be Nassen's, you know, saver and protector and surrogate father.
I do want to talk a little bit about Shafa because. You know, at the first that we see him, he's underwater and basically about to drown, right?
Right.
And something happens that allows him to survive, but at a certain amount of a loss, right? Brain damage of some kind, to where he loses a lot of his memory of who he was. And I think that makes it easier to swallow him being sort of a kindler, gentler Shafa, not gentler, obviously, all the way, because he disposes of some other guardians in very gruesome ways. but I wonder if we didn't have that, if we had just had him survive and then come around to the idea that maybe I shouldn't obey the dictates of whatever technology I have in my head that tells me to do these different things. Maybe I should resist that. I think his conversion would be harder to swallow if we didn't know that it was also a result of some kind of memory loss and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. He's unstable and he's becoming something else, but he's also lost a part of who he was.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think that does make it easier to forgive some of, you know, the violence that he did against her. And I think it's interesting that, you know, very much toward the beginning of the book, you know, he's thinking about what just happened at the end of the last book, and his incomprehension that Essen would kill Corndum rather than let him go with Shafa. And he, you know, he wonders to himself, doesn't she know that I'd love her son as much as I love her, and I would lay that boy down gently, so gently, in the wire chair. And to me, that just horrifying trauma and really shows that even in his, even as he was doing his worst to her, even before his transformation, he thought of it as loving her.
Right.
Isn't that scary?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. So I was trying to figure out what is different about him as a guardian, you know, as a result of kind of the brain damage that he got. I don't know what happened there, right? It seemed like he had an offer from some power. I can save you. It's going to come at a cost. But it makes him into a less cruel person overall. And so is the earth really evil that you know, corrupted him and now makes him the kind of guardian that kind of resists that itch that he has to take from Origins?
It's a good question. I think to me, you know, I've read this book a couple of times, and as we were talking about before, it's not all clear up front. But in thinking about it, I've come to see it as a sort of a by allowing, you know, evil Earth to have more power within Shafa, he also cleared his own slate a bit. So he has to struggle harder against evil Earth. But he also has a little bit more of a fresh start than he did before. And, you know, I'll leave it to everybody, you know, evil Earth, even, you know, he is, as Earth is portrayed in this book, you know, is seeking vengeance for his only son being lost.
Right.
And you can empathize with the Earth for why it could be so angry and wanting to punish the Origins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No good guys, no bad guys. Everybody's a mix. Even the 8-year-old girl.
Right. Or, you know, you think about Hoa, right? The stone eater. And you're like, oh, this is a good person. Like, you know, is everything he's doing okay?
Yeah. I love when he calls Essen my treasure, my pawn.
Right.
And I just think it's so delicious in that, in that, like the balance between good and evil that's happening in all of these characters.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we could talk about the Stone Eaters as well, where they seem to have different factions that are like, hey, if we don't need the humans and we should get rid of them. The origins are dangerous to us. But then there's also the thing about, you know, powerful origins can turn into stone and then apparently become Stone Eaters. And this brings up a theory that I have about why the second person thing is happening, because at the end of this book, you have apparently Alabaster reborn as a Stone Eater, but seems to be missing some memory. And so my theory about this, and you don't have to tell me, I'm sure I will find out in the next book, that Hoa is relating Esun's past life to her as she has emerged as a new Stone Eater. But that's something that I'll have to find out.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't spoil it for you. Okay. But I remember from your talk about the first book that you were so intrigued to learn more about the Stone Eaters. And I was thinking, just wait, Seth.
Yeah.
For the second book, you're going to have so much fun with that. So did you like, what did you think about what you learned about them, that they were all people once and they've forgotten how to be people? What did you think?
I thought that was interesting. And this book doesn't have that much about it, right? It has that sort of history lesson from Alabaster where he talks about on the other side of the world, there's this huge pit, which was apparently where I guess they built one of the obelisks or something. But they did something to cause the moon to go into a widely eccentric orbit. That was fascinating. And now the problem with starting the third book already is I'm already getting things mixed up between, did I read that in the third one or in the second one? So I wouldn't feel confident to say what happened.
Go down that path too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't want to spoil the third book for anyone.
Yeah.
At the end of this book, at the very end, final scene, one of Essen's arms is turned to stone.
Right.
And as you said, Alabaster has transitioned but doesn't seem to remember, but some, you know, kind of lives on as the Stone Eater.
Mm-hmm.
We get to watch Hoa a lot more as he has to go through a mini transformation and stop pretending to be human and be something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that was horrifying when he had been attacked and like his jaw was missing or something. It was very visceral.
It was visceral. You know, there's so much terrible violence in these books, and yet it's still so shocking and raw.
Yeah. Yeah.
She has that ability to make each scene of violence horrifying.
Yeah, there's a lot of body horror about the, you know, turning to stone and then the whole metamorphosis of Hoa back into a more typical Stone Eater form in his cocoon. That was kind of cool.
Absolutely. I had a friend who read these books after I pressed them on her, but for her the boil bugs were like the end. Yeah. She just was like, I don't, you know, it I think maybe on your point scale it might have brought the books down a notch for her, because she couldn't handle those boil bugs. And Essen even has to seal everyone outside and set the boil bugs on them, even some of her own community.
Yeah.
Oof, hard choice, huh?
Yeah. It was a very cool moment when she finally figured out kind of what Alabaster had been saying, you know, first the network and then the gate.
Yes.
And where she kind of finally figures out how to access all the obelisks and use them. And, you know, there's that moment where she's kind of torn, like you said. I can summon all the boil bugs to try and take down the people from, what was the name of the other calm? Begins with
Renanus.
Renanus, yes. And then, you know, you have to seal off your people from it. And some of their people are on this side and some of our people are on the other side of the door, but then ultimately deciding to just turn everyone to stone in that calm, which is, you know, genocide almost, you know, it's terrible, but a cool climactic moment in the book.
It really was. And Nassen, you know, has to do the same or decides to do the same thing with the Antarctic Fulcrum, where has this revelatory moment with her, with one of the Grits who's, you know, says, did they break your hand yet?
Right.
And in her vengeance that she pushes back against the Fulcrum, she includes the Grits, you know, who also die, who are victims as much as she is.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that's a difficult moment too, to stay connected to Nassen through that, but her, you know, understand her rage that pushes her through,
right,
to do things that she never could have imagined, you know, both like morally and even, you know, through her power.
Yeah. And there's the climactic moment for her with Jija too, where she's been slowly kind of realizing this is never going to work, you know, because like you mentioned in the opening, right, he's taking her to gay conversion therapy, right?
Yes.
And which does not work. And there's a family connection here that's painful for me. One of my cousins. And he's impatient for her to get over her orogeny, to try not being an orogene, right? And ultimately she realizes this is, he doesn't actually love me the way I am. He'll only only really love me as a father if I can do the thing that he wants. And I like that she's a little clumsy about the whole final confrontation there, where she doesn't act swiftly enough to stop him and ends up with a wound, because she doesn't realize just how, what's going to happen. But it's also kind of cool that Essun would have probably done something different to stop him. But the fact that she kind of instinctively turned him into like glass or crystal was really interesting to me. Like, not typical origin stuff.
Yeah. She's able to break out of the teaching and think and do things that are totally new, which I'd love to talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
Before we move on away from this topic though, I wanted to just follow up on what you said, you know, about Jija and Nassen's relationship. And I was talking a bit earlier in the podcast, you know, about how much I empathize with that. Didn't want to spoil anything. So now here we're in the non-spoilers.
Yeah.
But to me, I think that I, and probably people even who aren't in the LGBTQ community, might have experienced, you know, a feeling of love from their parents, but not a love of all of you.
Yeah.
You know, that they wish something about you could be different.
Mm-hmm.
And how difficult that is and how painful it is. You know, growing up, I and probably a lot of other people, you know, were taught that, you know, that being attracted to another woman was wrong.
Yeah.
That God wanted us to resist those impulses, mm-hmm. That it was bad. And I think that, you know, it's really compelling and so human to watch Nassen struggle with that and to come out and to say, you know, she doesn't want to change that part of herself.
Right.
She loves that part of herself and she mm-hmm. loves who she is. And, you know, I think that's really powerful for a lot of people who, you know, even, you know, like me, who's privileged enough to live in this time of tolerance, you know, and, you know, fewer rights denied, but still not loving acceptance and tolerance is not the same as,
right.
you know, being loved for your whole self.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like you, this is something that maybe also, the book, you know, made you think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just I was approaching it as a father and trying to put myself in Jija's shoes and
ooh.
I can't imagine there being anything with my son that would cause me to say, well, if he changes this one thing, then I'll love him. Or I love him contingent on this other thing. It just doesn't compute to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also not been in that kind of situation either. And I know the way that the teachings that I was raised under. And so I don't know. I don't know how much better I would do than Jija. And that's one of those things, right? Where you're like, no good guys here.
That's right. We're all just struggling. We're struggling, you know, based on, you know, how we were raised. You know, I've talked to my parents about that and, you know, they were raised in a very different culture even than I was. And, you know, it takes time and culture changing and people changing to see and understand new ideas.
Yeah.
And I'd love to talk to you a little bit too about our education and our upbringings and how that somewhat limits us, because that was really interesting in the book, right? With Nassen
yeah.
and Ika.
Right. Yeah, I definitely want to talk. I had just written down instinctive orogeny versus the fulcrum orogeny. Because, yeah, why don't you go ahead and kick that one off for us?
Well, I've heard you talk in your podcast before about how you have come to change your thinking about some of the ways that you grew up and probably were taught either in church or in school, and you know, how transformational that was for you.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to hear your thoughts on this, and this idea of like sort of breaking through or realizing, everything I'm taught, you know, some of this really doesn't resonate.
Yeah.
And what that opens up for people in their lives.
Yeah. I mean, and in this book in particular, right, you have fulcrum orogeny, which is this very, it's the kind of thing that somebody who is a fulcrum trained origin, like Essun, she sees all orogeny through that lens. And so she would see someone like Yika, and say, you're doing that wrong. Right. and then you have an interesting mixture of it where you have sort of Essun had transferred some of the fulcrum teachings to Nasun, but not enough because she's only 10, I think, by the end of the book. To the point where she kind of also has this instinctive thing where she starts to recognize the magic and realize there's things you can do with orogeny and there's things you can do with magic, and they're not, it's not a one-to-one correspondence. There's different ways of accomplishing things. And that, you know, that has applications out into society and the business world, and you know, having somebody come in and say, well, we've always done it this way, but does that make it the right way? Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't necessarily. Or like you said, right, well, we've always interpreted these verses in the Bible from a white cis hetero male perspective. Is it teaching that, or is that just what the teaching was handed to us by those types of people, and therefore we took it on board and went, well, I'm a white cis het male, and it's easy for me to just take it and go, okay, well, I'll just on board that, and that is the way it is, without thinking about it from perspectives of different people.
Yes, that's an interesting point. That our own upbringings, you know, cause us to learn things and think about things in a certain way. And we have to kind of be pushed out of that, you know, to think in different ways.
Yeah.
And then I think, so there's kind of like a natural or a, I don't know if natural is the right word, but there's a tendency to just see things from our own perspective. And then in this book, we also see a very deliberate push to message and shape and control truth and history.
Yeah.
And those snippets of stone lore really help us understand that this did not happen by accident.
Right.
This didn't happen only from a lack of empathy. You know, it was so deliberate. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, can you think of any time, anything that you learned in school or history you remember learning that later you scratched your head and thought, oh, wait, I think that this was a deliberate you know, example of the victors getting to write the history books.
Oof. Yeah. I'm not sure I can come up with a specific example. Just, I think, as a lifelong Christian and somebody who reads the Bible, there's some reckoning that everybody has to do with, especially stuff that happens in the Old Testament and some of the conquest narrative, where you look at that and you're like, if I was writing this, would I write that God told me to do it? And yeah, I probably would. And so is that possibly what happened here, rather than literally God saying, go and strike down every man, woman, and child in this village? And that's, you know, you're asking those questions, you're moving away from a very conservative way of reading the Bible into a more, well, can we not assume that the ancients knew more than we did? And that's something that I've been thinking about recently, not prioritizing earlier teachings and earlier writers and that kind of thing, and saying, well, they knew better than we did. Are we sure they knew better than we did? Because I don't know that we're sure about that. Maybe they did, but maybe they didn't. And that can change the way you kind of value the history of interpretation of things. And, you know, this is one of those things about being a Protestant, right? I don't have a teaching authority in my church or in my life to say, this is what you will believe here. I have a lot of history and history of interpretation, that kind of stuff, but nothing authoritative. Like if you're Catholic or Orthodox, you know, there's a teaching authority in the church that says, on these things, you will believe X, Y, and Z. On these others, you have liberty, but these ones you will believe X, Y, and Z.
I didn't think of those comparisons to, I immediately went to, public school education. That's the great thing about discussing this book, discussing books with someone, is that they can bring a totally new idea. And I hadn't thought about it as interpreting scripture in that way.
Yeah. It's something that's been on my mind a lot, just kind of as I've moved a little more progressive and accepting of science and that kind of stuff. And I've actually been talking with some people about doing a video discussion about Christians who accept evolution. Eventually we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I love it when different books and different topics of interest intersect with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, did you have an example from public school education?
Oh, goodness. Maybe in talking about the Civil War and the motivations of the South, and some whitewashing, nothing specific, but I recall reading whitewashed versions where, the South's motivations were justified by states' rights or economic interests or something.
Yeah.
And books like The New Jim Crow and other books, help me to remember, hey, wait, in writing the Constitution, African Americans or slaves were considered 3/5 of a person.
Right.
That is a big problem and a big shift. Mm-hmm. And I think, more than anything specific, just a general not acknowledgement of that.
Yeah.
And not enough, I think, in my education. And I'm hopeful that we're moving in the right direction on that.
Yeah, that's definitely, something that I've thought about, and I talked about it on the podcast with Nick Bucola, that I remember, hearing the term Black History Month and thinking, well, that's not for me. Because I'm a white person. And then all of a sudden going, wait a second. I mean, this is essentially saying, hey, there's a subsection of American history that we don't commonly get taught. And I don't know why. I was just always kind of going, well, that's not for me. I don't need to know any of that. And now going, no, that it's important to learn from different perspectives and learn things that you aren't commonly taught. And that's one of those things, right? The blind spots in American history teaching in schools.
Yep. I think you're right about that.
I was trying to figure out what, found moon, what did the name of that com mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. Do you have any ideas about that?
I don't really, but I feel like the fact that it has the word moon in it is important. I just don't know why.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm not sure either. It was interesting that Gija was asking at campfires the question of, have you heard of the moon? Do you know about the moon? At the same time that Essen was asking the question. Yeah. Do you think found moon was like a trap set up to get Origenes in a place, like by the stone eaters? Mm. Who's trying to find the moon? The people who want to catch the moon and bring it back. And then the people who want to, permanently send it away and end life.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. If it's like a trap for anybody who seeks the moon, will find their way here somehow. But it's another interesting thing in this book about the timescales of human history and human remembrance. Because if the moon, it only comes around every couple thousand years. I mean, think of how well we really know history from 1,000 years ago. It's not amazing, right? Language was completely different. Like if you went back to 1022, right? They're not speaking the English that we speak today. In fact, in English, in England, was 1066 was the Norman conquest. So, everybody was speaking French not long after that. And so the idea that you could preserve knowledge of something like the moon over those timescales, I don't know. If nobody's seen the moon in 1,000 years, it's just going to seem like a legend.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the current regime has been in place for 25,000 years.
Yeah.
That's when the stone laurels were discredited. And so that's a pretty long time, you know, for one system to be working. And then they talk about cultures even before that was founded. So yeah. Amazingly long time periods they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about this book as a middle book in a series, you know, I have seen that some people are like, oh, it's a middle book. It's, you know, it's not up to the standards of the first one. And when you think about it from like a character development standpoint, you do get a lot more of that in the first book, just because you have Essun in several different parts of her life, where mm-hmm. here it's a smaller time scale overall. And so you don't move her forward as much as possible, but you do get that recognition from her that, hey, this, my perspective as seeing Orogeny through the lens of the fulcrum isn't right. You know, Yika can do some amazing things with her Orogeny just instinctively. What did she call them? Instinctive origins, or I can't remember.
Oh, ferals?
Ferals, yeah, that's right. So kind of her coming around to understand that my institutionalized knowledge of Orogeny is not everything. And she learns from Yika the kind of networking, which I thought was really cool.
I thought that was cool too, and interesting that we hear from Nida, a guardian gone rogue next to Shafa with not maybe so many great intentions.
Yeah.
And then also from Alabaster, you know, both of them confirming that the fulcrum culls, which is such a frightening term to use for humans, but they cull out people who reach for the sky and that have that powerful, right. Magical ability. And they send them to the nodes, you know, they incapacitate them and send them to a horrible fate in the nodes.
Yeah.
And that, it, you know, that it's this deliberate push to keep people from reaching from that power. And in some ways, a response to what Origins actually did with their power, which was break everything, essentially.
Right. Yeah. But that also, you know, doing that serves to keep the status quo in place.
It sure does.
It's not, doing that is never going to move them towards, is there a way to solve this? Can we bring the moon back? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
absolutely.
It's a very kind of wise insight into the way humans work too. We're like, this is the way we do things. We've always done it this way. And yeah, okay. We're not progressing, but we're maintaining, you know, the conservative impulse to like this, we maintain this. This is what we hold on to, what we had before. And we don't think too much about, is there a better place to go?
I think, you know, speaking to the issue about the criticisms about a middle book, and I think some people's criticisms, you know, that why are we in Castrema so long?
Yeah.
Some people really felt that part dragged. To me, we were given these rare insights into leadership mm-hmm. from Yika, who's trying to be a leader, and Hjarka, who is a leader who, you know, someone who dropped out of the leadership cast. And then Tonki / Beanoff, who also rejected that leadership and was kind of rejected by mm-hmm. that power of position and turned into a scientist. And so we're learning about Yika, even with the best of intentions and the hope of equality and integration, still faces these struggles from inside Castrema and outside Castrema.
Yeah.
And I think really speaks to the need for a revolution. You know, why do we have to tear things out? Why do so many people have to die to change this? Because it is not workable and not possible.
Yeah. Tonki is a great character. I wanted more of her in the book.
You did. Yeah. I liked her too. What did you think of when she breaks into the control room and they say they're going to lock her out and she reaches for that metal thing and it gets right. in her arm?
Yeah. I was trying to figure out, you know, I wanted to know, is there any explanation of what was happening there with that thing? Cause it seemed to me it was trying. The closest possible analog I could think of was whatever the little piece of metal was in the brains of the guardians, if it was trying to turn her into a guardian, because it was just burrowing up her arm, right?
I think it was. And I think it was. And at one point, Essen communicates with it and it says, "Hello, little enemy." And
so it's like
the
Earth,
evil Earth in that little silver thing, you know, going for the brain. And what is it going to do if it takes over Tonki?
Right.
And Essen, you know, in her monstrous, heroic way, like, chops off her arm and is holding it in her hand. Oh my gosh, that scene was crazy. I love Tonki too. I loved that scene, you know, all the parts leading up to that big action, because Tonki is, in her hilarious, deprecating way, you know, explaining all these things she knows. She's been to a half dozen of these obelisk maker sites, so she can compare them. She can read some of the symbologies. You know, she's helping us understand what exactly happened. And I, that really stimulated, you know, that part of the story, and so stimulated my brain to be thinking about, you know, what's going on behind the scenes as we try to figure out who are these three factions in the secret war.
Yeah,
and you know, love Tonki. She's so funny.
Yeah. What I was trying to figure out was if it was trying to make her into a guardian. My understanding is that guardians are sort of corrupted origins.
Oh.
Or at least that's what I had always thought. They must have, I thought they had Cesapine as well, but maybe I'm wrong about that. Or maybe that's something from the third book that's creeping in.
My understanding is that everybody has Cesapine and the origins just have a lot more of it.
Okay.
More of that power, and that the guardians are often offsprings of origins that aren't quite developed enough to be origins.
Okay.
And that's the impression that I got too, that that's what Shafa was. And isn't it interesting? You know, he's saying he can remember his mother and he remembers his father, who seemed very normal, suspiciously normal. And now he knows that people who try very hard to seem normal are often hiding something.
Right.
And they put him in that chair. So those little sliver things would have turned her into a guardian, you know, somewhat corrupted, but with some powers of the Earth, and also the Earth's like need for vengeance. And it would have gone into Tonki, which I would have been so bummed about, because she continues being hilarious throughout the rest of the book, having her relationship that, like, a total nerd does not understand relationships and thinks they're, you know, a distraction from what really needs to be done.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think she brings a lot of levity to the book.
Mm-hmm. I think I've run out of my notes.
I think, you know, this is a great book. I need to recommend it to everybody, and everybody should read it. And but don't read the second book before you read the first.
Right.
And I'm really looking for, do you already know when you're going to discuss your third book?
Nope, it's not on the schedule.
Okay.
I think I have 11 unscheduled books, and that's
nice.
One of them. So
yeah, great. Well, it's something to look forward to, because there's a lot more to talk about and think about with the third book. So I'll read along and again the third book and be ready to listen in when you talk about it.
Nice. And usually what I do is I go back and listen to the previous episode.
Good. So this will be a reminder.
Yeah.
I want to hear, you know, what you think about the Stone Eaters, you know, after the third book, and, you know, these questions about what it means to be good and bad. There's a lot left to talk about there.
Yeah. Cool. All right. And that suffices for your final thoughts, I guess.
Those are my final thoughts. Read the book if you haven't.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was really good, and I'm very much looking forward to the next one. So, which I'm glad, because like I said, I was a little apprehensive because I didn't remember the audiobook. So it's nice when you find that a book is really readable, and this book is very readable. It's got some tough content, but
it does. Yeah. I think so much. I think to me, you know, while I enjoyed The Forever War, you know, I enjoyed Neuromancer and, you know, some of those books struggling with other, you know, new social concepts. To me, this just seemed so much fuller and more full of life and humanity, and really exciting to see science fiction, you know, start to incorporate those things, especially compared to those 1950s Heinleins and things.
Yep, definitely. Okay, so before we sign off, is there any place you want people to be able to find you, or are you anonymous online?
I'm anonymous online, but let me take the opportunity to shout out two great used bookstores in Seattle.
Okay.
You can, if you're looking for me, you can find me at Twice Sold Tales in Capitol Hill. They have used books and kittens. So check it out if you're in the Seattle area. And then Third Place Books, there's a few locations in Seattle and really knowledgeable staff. They have used and new books. So if you just can't wait for something, you can order it, which is often the case for me. So great book scene in Seattle.
Nice. Well, I'll plug Powell's in Portland. It's another
yes. Now, let me tell you that Powell's also set me down the path of reading the Hugos because they have those suggested reading lists. And right. That's what I've been, as I go, checking off all my Hugos on my bookmark. And I've got 67 down, 3 to go.
Nice. Are you going through more or less in order, or are you
I'm doing it random. I'm doing it randomly because I do love those used books, and you never know what you're going to find. You got to comb through, but also make slightly disjointed to go from reading N.K. Jemisin to Heinlein to the Forever War. it's been interesting for sure.
Yeah. Well, Lacey Jane, thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for being patient. Well, it's been a while since you first contacted me, and the queue is slow, but it was great having you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was my pleasure, Seth. Please keep up the great work. I love your show and really appreciate and love looking forward to listening to your episodes.
Thank you. All right. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.